is China Law and Policy, and welcome to our podcast. Back in January, Beijing saw some of the worst air pollution in its modern history. Even the state-run media, which usually tries to cover up environmental disasters, openly discussed the off-the-chart pollution levels that were literally suffocating the city. Did this open discussion signal change? Certainly over the past decade, China has passed many environmental protection laws. There has been increasing citizen awareness and, on occasion, government responsiveness. But what role has the law and litigation played in moving Chinese society forward? To help us understand where China is at in terms of environmental litigation is Rachel Stern, Assistant Professor of Law and Politics at UC Berkeley. Professor Stern has had the fortunate opportunity to study and observe the development of China's environmental laws and litigation, and has recently published her analysis in an amazing book, Environmental Litigation in China, A Study in Political Ambivalence. Thank you for joining us today, Rachel.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start with the pollution in Beijing this past January, specifically the horrible smog that covered the city for days, with residents being warned not to leave their homes. A lot of outsiders compared the Beijing smog in January to the Great London smog of 1952 or the New York City's killer smog of 1966. First off, do you think it's fair to compare Beijing's pollution to London's in the 50s or New York in the 60s? Is this the same level and type of pollution?
Well, I can certainly see where the comparison is coming from. All those examples you mentioned are all examples of air pollution in major cities that are driven by, that are an outcome of industrialization and economic development. They're huge crisis events that really galvanize the public and draw attention to an issue area. So sure, I think the comparison is fair. Whether or not it's totally accurate is a little harder to say, just because it's hard to get, at the risk of sounding like a social scientist, it's hard to get data that is exactly comparable. So one of the things that was in the news that you probably know about was that China just started measuring particulate matter under 2.5 microns
in
January. So whether or not the quality of the smog is exactly the same, it's really hard to compare. That London smog that you mentioned, I just glanced back at some of the historical accounts. There were accounts that 4,000 people died in that smog.
Right.
So that's not quite the same as the airpocalypse that we're coming out of. But I do think that the events are comparable in terms of drawing attention to a problem and sort of galvanizing the public behind the issue.
And that's what I think like a lot of foreign journalists and China watchers kind of also looked at when they compared Beijing to London and New York, that they argued that these kinds of incidents are necessary to get the society on board to promote environmental awareness and movements. But to what extent do you think China is different from London or the United States? I mean, do you think the fact that China is a one-party state with a developing legal system will cause a different result?
Of course, the fact that it's a one-party state with a developing legal system shapes all the possibilities for environmental activism in China. Let me start with the part where they're actually kind of the same. I think one of the things we see in environmental movements worldwide is the difference between crisis events and chronic problems. So chronic problems, the fact that air pollution is terrible day in and day out, in general what happens is people learn to live with it. It just becomes the new normal. And sometimes you get this with Chinese friends who are visiting the States for the first time and hadn't realized that it could be different.
Right.
So the role of the crisis event is to create a sense of urgency. Mm-hmm. And crisis events, for that reason, tend to play a really large role in environmental movements. So I'm actually hopeful that the apocalypse will play a similar kind of role in China as the Great Smog and other events like that did in the United States.
Right.
What's so different in China is that the opportunities for public participation are so much more limited. And we'll talk more about this, but it's really hard for NGOs to bring environmental litigation under the current legal system. So that's really different than here in the United States, where NRDC and the Sierra Club were really instrumental in some of the major pollution lawsuits of the 1960s and 1970s. Right. And of course, there's no elections. So that's really different from Japan, where the LDP started to take on environmental issues when they started losing elections over it. So that mechanism of accountability is somewhat broken in the Chinese case as well.
Yeah. Now, you had mentioned, like, in comparing London and New York's Beijing right now, that, you know, it is kind of similar path with the industrialization. And so let's rewind a bit with, like, China and focus now just on China. China basically kind of starts industrializing in the early 1980s with Deng Xiaoping. And with that, we see the increasing environmental pollution and degradation. But when do you see the development of an environmental movement or concern about the environment? I know the past decade we've seen a lot of laws,
change,
but have you seen it before that? And was there a certain incident or crisis moment that really sparked public and government attention to the issue before 2000?
Yeah. So I always felt uncomfortable talking about China's environmental movement. I think I only started using that term, like, with some degree of comfort maybe last year.
Okay.
It was really recent.
Well, what made you uncomfortable about using it?
Well,
a
movement implies a sustained political push by a large group of people. So China's first environmental NGO was founded in 1994 by Liang Zongjie, that's Friends of Nature.
Okay.
So there's that's sort of the first generation of environmental NGOs in China is in the 1990s. And they had a few really notable successes, particularly drawing attention to the hunting of a rare Tibetan antelope. That was one of the big early Friends of Nature successes.
Okay.
But throughout that early period, the NGOs are really focused on environmental education and raising awareness of environmental issues. And they really had their work cut out for them. When I think about surveys from the 1990s, there were just a few, but they're really super interesting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
One of the survey questions that got asked, for example, in one of these surveys in Anhui province was, have you ever heard of the term environmental protection? Have you ever heard of the term Huanbao?
Mm-hmm.
And over 90% of people said, nope, never heard of it.
And who were these, like, surveys given out to? Like, who gave out the surveys, and then was it just a general public?
No, it was a general public
okay. In
a rural part of Anhui province.
Okay, and was this sponsored by the Friends of Nature NGO? Or
no, this was a group of environmental researchers that were both in China.
There was
a joint Sino-American team.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the story throughout most of the 1990s, and then attention to environmental issues really started to pick up in the 2000s. There was a dramatic expansion of the NGO sector in general, and blossoming numbers of environmental NGOs were a big part of that story. And with more groups, you got more diversity of approaches. And this coincided with a time when the central government really started making environment more of a priority, too.
Right.
So one of the key moments was in 2007, when Wen Jiabao introduced the phrase ecological civilization, Shangtai Wenming, at the 17th Party Congress. And a lot of observers, both within China and outside of it, really saw that as a sign of that environmental issues were rising in prominence for the central government. So that was a big event, that 17th Party Congress, the Green Olympics, of course, Beijing.
Mm-hmm.
Is it going to be possible to hold an Olympics in one of the world's most polluted cities?
Right.
That was
right.
A huge event in the 2000s. And then I also the cancer villages
right. And
the amount of media attention surrounding villages where there were lots and lots of people dying of cancer. And the media, this was all the Chinese media, not the international media, but the linking of those cancer cases to pollution were three of the events in the 2000s that really, really jacked attention to environmental issues inside of China. And as the decade has worn on, we've started to see more of the NIMBY protests, especially in the urban areas. I finally started to feel more comfortable thinking about an environmental movement.
Okay.
that's widespread enough. It isn't just a few people.
Right, right. So in terms, you had said before that, you know, you don't have elections in China
and
that there's less accountability, but this media attention to some of these cancer villages, the fear of 2008 Olympics being like a pollution nightmare for the government. I mean, there is, in a way, some, like, accountability or...
I think there's definitely responsiveness.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I guess that's different. Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's some degree of accountability, too, through responsiveness. It's just that the mechanisms are different.
Right.
You don't have election. You know, in democracies, elections are the mechanism by which government officials are held accountable.
Yes.
And here you have a government that's really trying to be responsive. And you see this all the time in the kind of NIMBY protests that come out of urban areas. They actually back down quite a bit and give urban residents what they want. But that's because of fears of unrest or media pressure or being embarrassed, not because of elections.
Now, in terms of, like, the Chinese government responding to some of this pressure. So the past decade has seen an enormous amount of laws written for environmental protection.
Yeah, huge numbers.
And you discuss this in your book, Environmental Litigation in China. Now, just based on what's written, how well written are they and how thought out are they?
I think they're pretty well thought out. This is, it's part of a big trend towards drafting lots of laws. There's been the 1990s and 2000s were boom times for legal drafters in China. There are just laws being drafted all the time on all subjects. We can't have gaps. And often the process of legal drafting is a really thoughtful one of looking around the world, seeing what other countries do, trying to pick and choose the elements, the best practices that are really going to work well for China. So I think over the course of the last decade, the consensus has changed a little bit from saying China doesn't have enough environmental laws to saying, well, the laws that we have on the books, they're not perfect, but they're not bad.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think the consensus has shifted to thinking that the problem is really about enforcement.
Okay, yeah.
About, the gap between what should be happening and what's actually happening.
Right, and in terms of that, so with that gap, so you do have these laws, and presumably with these laws, you would see an increase in environmental litigation. Is that what your studies have shown? Has there been an increase in citizen litigation of environmental claims in China? And what is, the status of that litigation?
Yeah, I wish we had better data on that. That would be really nice if you were writing a book on environmental litigation in China. All research is limited by the statistics that the Chinese government chooses to release. And the data on the numbers of environmental lawsuits have been really piecemeal. So the best data I have is from a Supreme People's Court work report, 2011. They announced that there were about 12,000 civil lawsuits the year before, so that would be 2010. Mm-hmm. And the volume of litigation going through the legal system in general is about 4.1 million civil cases a year. So we've got a tiny fraction.
So it's very small.
Yeah, it's very small, but that would be true in all legal systems.
Okay.
Environmental lawsuits are always a pretty small portion of what's going. Most civil cases.
So,
courts
in the
are busy.
United States, do you know what percent? Or
I don't know about. I don't know the exact percent, but the numbers would be roughly comparable.
Would be comparable.
Most of the, courts are mostly busy handling dispute, divorce, family matters, the kind of stuff that people is much more every day.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure the numbers of environmental lawsuits have been rising because there is clear data that the numbers of environmental disputes have been rising.
Okay.
So if disputes are going up, my expectation is that lawsuits are going up as well.
And in terms of these lawsuits, I guess keep in mind that a lot of people who read this blog are American students of law or students of American law. I guess what are these, what do these cases look like? I mean, are they largely angry citizens bringing these suits on their own, pro se? What role do nonprofits play? Is there a Sierra Club or an NRDC in China? And how do these cases play out in the courts in China?
So most of the cases are what lawyers call tort cases.
Right.
The cases that I'm looking at, which are civil cases.
Right, and a tort case is basically a case where somebody's been injured.
Yeah, exactly. So they involve monetary compensation for damages.
Right.
The archetypal case that I always think about is there's a chemical factory upstream, and there's a guy farming fish downstream, and there's a chemical spill at the chemical factory, and the fish farmer wakes up and all of his fish are dead, and he wants 10,000 renminbi from the chemical factory to pay for the dead fish.
Right.
So that's where the average case is in the Chinese legal system. It's not about environmental rights per se. It's about money.
It's about monetary damage.
It's about monetary damages, and it's not necessarily about health. When I was doing this, when I was writing this book in the late 2000s, the end of the first decade of the 2000s, lawyers were trying to get money for health claims for pollution victims, and that was very much on the frontier.
Okay.
That was, if you could get money for a cancer victim and link that case to pollution, that was a huge victory. That was not the mainstream case that was going through the legal system at all.
More of a result of evidence issues to show that the Because, I mean, I know even in the United States, like, you see Erin Brockovich, which you mentioned in your book, which I thought was funny, you know, proving that people's cancer is a result of a certain chemical is hard even in the United States. Is that hard to show even more in China, where presumably you wouldn't have the resources because lawyers aren't paid maybe in the same way?
Yeah, I think there's two things going on. I think the issue you're talking about is causation, which is really hard. I mean, this is so hard in all environmental lawsuits. It doesn't matter if they're happening in China or Zambia or New Jersey. That link is always super hard. And it's really hard for Chinese judges to figure it out. I mean, here in the U.S., we would have competing experts dueling it out over what the groundwater patterns show. And in China, what they tend to do is they tend to outsource this issue of causation to an appraisal agency. So judges' impulse is usually to find a neutral third party to write something up. And one of the big issues that comes out of that came out of my fieldwork was that the quality of these appraisals is all over the place. Sometimes they're done really conscientiously by people with a really strong background in environmental science, and they're really good. And sometimes they're really awful and done by people who have no idea what they're talking about.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot of quality control. So, I mean, that's the critical piece of evidence when it exists in these cases. And one of the steps forward for Chinese environmental litigation to work better is you have to control the quality of these appraisals better than has been done in the past.
And in terms of environmental cases getting into the court system, because I know a lot of people talk about how the courts don't have to take a case.
No, they sure don't.
How successful are environmental cases in making it past that first hurdle?
It's really hard.
Yeah.
I think that's actually the biggest stumbling block. I think it's getting the case into court and convincing judges, the judges at the case acceptance division of the court, that this is a good way to handle the dispute. That's the moment in which the case is likely to be turned away. The best data I have suggests that if you get your case accepted by the court as a plaintiff in one of these environmental lawsuits, plaintiffs will get something. Not everything they want. Maybe it's just one renminbi, but they'll get something 50% of the time. So the big stumbling block is getting it in the door and convincing judges that this is a case that they can deal with. That's within the court's jurisdiction and realm of possibility.
Right. And in terms of, I mean, do you ever see, like, you have the monetary relief, so you have to show damages for that guy whose fish are all dead because of chemicals in the water. Do you ever see cases where they ask for injunctive relief, where they ask for the industry to stop polluting, to shut down the industry, or anything like that?
Yeah, so a very typical sentence in an environmental decision will call on the polluter to stop harm.
Okay.
It's not an injunction, that's usually part of the decision. The problem, of course, is enforcement. I mean, it's very rare for the courts to follow up make sure that the decision is actually enforced. So one of the more exciting things that's been happening is that some of the environmental courts have been working with the Environmental Protection Bureau to establish monitoring of decisions after the fact to make sure that there's a cleanup plan and that it actually happens.
Okay.
But again, that's really the frontier.
That's
the frontier of where environmental law is going, as opposed to the mainstream of where it is right this second.
I mean, I guess, like, given all of that, I mean, do you think there are, like, successful environmental cases in China? I mean, you had talked in one of your chapters in the book about the Pingnan case, where the villagers won on the law, right?
Yeah.
Like, they ostensibly won. The company had to clean up the pollution and pay a fine. But ultimately, the fine amounted to such a small amount of money,
$63. Isn't that a depressing story?
It was very depressing.
Especially because this was, like, the most celebrated environmental lawsuit of 2006.
Right.
So this was, like, trumpeted as a major victory. And then glass is half empty, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's not that much.
I mean, in your mind, and I guess in some of the people that are on the forefront of the environmental movement in China, some of the lawyers and the judges in the environmental courts and the government agencies that deal with it, I mean, how do they define victory? Do they really see this as a victory? Do they understand that it's not
definitely see Pingnan as a victory.
Okay.
Not so much because of what the villagers got, but because of the media attention that story got and the way in which it called attention to the issue and the way in which it reframed the debate. Mm-hmm. So the media attention itself is a victory, regardless of what people actually get, because it's questioning the articles kind of that came out of the Pingnan lawsuit are questioning the old economic growth at all costs model that China has been on for so long. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So insofar as that the real story is about raising environmental consciousness and creating the groundwork for an environmental movement, any lawsuit that gets national attention is a success. But it's hard to know. I mean, you know, I would sometimes in my interviews, I would ask lawyers, can you tell me about a successful lawsuit? And they'd come back with a story of, you know, the punchline of the successful lawsuit for them is often the factory closed up and moved away. And so my next question is, where did it go? And the answer is often, you know, it went to this poorer part of the province.
Right.
So is that a real victory? You know, it is for the people who live in that place, but it raises real concerns about environmental justice and you know, whether or not these lawsuits are, you know, if you take the nation as the unit of analysis, whether or not they're really doing that much to improve environmental quality.
Right.
So this is such a tough field.
Yeah,
you know, it's the kind of, you have to celebrate every little success, even if it doesn't add up to, you know, success on the level of Brown versus the Board of Education.
Right.
Or a case that's
that
big.
I mean, when that came down, wasn't enforced in a lot of places. It was just enforced in that one, and then the Supreme Court decided to wait to integrate. So, I mean, I guess it is kind of fair to see Pingnan as a victim, because it did get media attention and did raise rights consciousness, but then it was a little bit of money for the people that were harmed.
I know. You know, and I find that, again, just speaking in general, the plaintiffs tend to be pretty happy if they get any part of what they wanted.
They really
feel like the deck is stacked against them in these type of cases, and if they get a fair hearing, and if they get a portion of what they wanted, they tend to think that that's a success.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think, like, right now are the roadblocks to what we would define as success, where the plaintiff is made more whole than they are being made right now? I mean, what are the major roadblocks that you're seeing in environmental litigation in China?
Well, we already mentioned two of the really big ones. One is getting the case into court and convincing judges that this is part of their responsibility, is to hear these kinds of cases, and improving the quality of appraisals so that they have a real scientific basis and judges can really rely on them.
Right.
I think that those two reforms would go a long way towards improving the quality of justice in these kinds of cases. The third one is enforcement of decisions. So putting teeth in the idea that you have to clean up after a decision, as opposed to basically pay off plaintiffs with a little bit of money, it would be the third thing. And I think for that really to work, there needs to be cooperation between the court and the Environmental Protection Bureau to a much deeper degree.
So right now, I mean, what are you seeing right now between the court and the Environmental Protection Bureau? So
usually nothing.
So in China, is it that when the court orders, you know, for the plant to stop polluting the water, is it then the responsibility of the local Environmental Protection Bureau to enforce that? Or
right now it's kind of no one's responsibility.
Oh, okay.
It's kind of in a gray zone where nobody's going to be held to task for it. Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to follow up. Everybody knows that. So, you know, you can imagine a situation. I mean, one of the criticisms of China sometimes is there's not enough judicial independence.
Right.
The courts are too likely to communicate with other branches of government. But the flip side is you could really take advantage of that.
Yeah.
If the courts were communicating with the EPB and making this cleanup part of the EPB's mandate, that could really make a big difference. Of course, the problem is that environmental protection bureaus are chronically underfunded and understaffed, so that problem needs to be addressed.
Yeah.
But at least the possibility is there.
You know, like when I was reading your book, and I mean, definitely these are problems in environmental litigation in China. But, I mean, honestly, like, a lot of this seems to be problems in a lot of, like, citizen rights cases, you know, disability rights, things like that. I mean, do you think this is also a problem in other fields?
Oh, totally. Totally. All of these, I mean, some of it's a little bit specific, like the issue with the appraisals,
that's a little
special. But problems getting cases accepted, problems getting decisions enforced.
Right.
This is totally endemic to the whole legal system.
Well, that's positive. At least it's not just focused on environmental issues.
No. It's not personal.
It's not personal. I mean, the other thing in reading your book is that it was like, you know, I think like a lot of people outside of China, because there's been so much press about China passing so many laws of environmental protection, that in the Western press there is this talk about an environmental movement in China. You see protests. So you think, like, oh, this is a hotbed of activity. Like, stuff is really happening here.
Yeah.
And then I read your book, and I'm like, oh, wait, no, not really. Like, no, not really.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, like, you know, you're not really, like, seeing that, but when I did read your book, I mean, one of the, and I know you've mentioned the Environmental Protection Bureaus before, but one of the, actually, the hopeful things I did read in it is that there were parts where you talked about the success of administrative litigation in China. I guess, what's been happening with administrative litigation in China in the environmental sphere, and can you just describe more what that looks like
vis-a-vis
civil litigation?
Sure. So the most hopeful thing that I found was not in the civil, not so much in terms of civil litigation, but it was, I think, give a shout out to Zhang Xuehua, whose research this really draws on.
Mm-hmm.
What she found was that there's this part of the environmental litigation law that's not that well known, and which is that they're called non-litigation administrative execution cases. I always have to look at my notes because I never get that quite right. But that's what they're called. And what it means, to put it in English, is under the administrative litigation law, government agencies can bring lawsuits in court when their administrative decisions are not being followed.
Okay.
So what she found in Hubei province was that sometimes the Environmental Protection Bureau brings these lawsuits in court to sue polluters who are not paying their fines, and to get the court's moral authority and help calling these polluters to task.
Okay.
And so you can get this kind of synergistic relationship and alliance that can emerge between the EPB and the courts.
Right.
So between two parts of the Chinese government that are traditionally perceived as very weak, they can kind of help each other out. Because the court doesn't have a lot of tools at its disposal, but two things they can do is they can initiate, they can detain managers of firms that are not paying up.
Okay.
And they can freeze bank accounts.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And plus they have some moral authority.
Right.
So if you put all of this together, sometimes the EPB bringing these lawsuits can scare polluters into thinking, wow, the courts have gotten involved, the judges have shown up, now I really have to pay.
Yeah.
And she's just describing this pattern, this alliance emerging in just a few places. But it's really optimistic that there is that possibility for cooperation between these bureaus, that they can get more done together than either one could ever get done on their own.
So you're seeing this in just a few places in China.
Yeah.
I mean, has it, like, spread since it started happening, since she started investigating Hubei? I mean, do you think this is a model that will spread throughout China, or...?
I don't know. I hope so.
They need something.
There's been quite a few of these non-litigation administrative execution cases in some of the environmental courts, in Wuxi in particular, and in Chongqing.
Okay.
In those two places, this type of case makes up a large percentage of what the court's dealing with.
Yeah.
And it's provided a real way for the court to get enough cases to justify its existence.
Right.
So I'm optimistic that this may be a path forward for the environmental courts in particular.
Mm-hmm.
That it kind of works out well for both sides.
Yeah.
The EPB brings cases, and that's a way for the environmental court to expand its caseload and reach a more stable footing.
Right. And just in terms of, like, the EPB, the Environmental Protection Bureaus on the local level, and then like, your book does talk about how, even though they still are underfunded and understaffed, mm-hmm. I mean, it does talk about the huge increase in the number of staff that they've had over the past decade, and that in 2008, the National Environmental Protection Administration was raised to a ministry level, which gives it more power. Is this changing, like, the culture of people who work there? I mean, what are the type of people that work there? I mean, I know in the United States you meet a lot of people who work at, like, EPA.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they're very into the environment, right?
Yeah.
And then they often go to NRDC and they'll go to Sierra Club. I mean, is that the culture that you're starting to see created in the government agencies that supervise environmental? Or is there still a lot of people where it's just a job?
I think, I mean, there's the visible upgraded status for the Environmental Protection Bureau employees over the last 10 years has been positive.
Right, right.
There's more of a feeling of pride in your work, in their work, as you would expect, as the work has more visible importance placed on it. I think there's a ways to go before everyone who works for the EPB is a dedicated environmentalist. In the interviews I've done with EPB officials, the discourse is usually less about it is about protecting the environment, but it's mostly about finding a more appropriate balance. This balance idea is used a lot. Finding a balance between economic growth and environmental protection and recalibrating that balance so that it's more appropriate for the current moment in China. And I think that makes sense for where China is right now and for the kind of rhetoric that's coming out of the central government. But it does strike me that there is a big gap between finding a balancing point between economic growth and environmental protection and being a fervent and committed environmentalist at all costs, as we might see here, at least in parts of EPA.
Right. And so just to switch gears a bit, I do want to focus on one of your last chapters in the book, which talks a lot about the foreign rule of law projects and the environmental aid projects that have been happening in China for the past decade. Now, as part of your research, you were able to attend some of these foreign-sponsored conferences and see some of the effects of this foreign aid. Can you give us a little bit of background on this and what the landscape looks like for foreign aid projects in the environmental sphere?
Sure. So I did most of the research for this book between the end of 2006 and the beginning of 2008.
Okay.
And I wasn't really originally planning to write about international NGOs or foreign aid, but as I was sort of doing my interviews in China at that point, I realized that it was impossible to really, it wasn't a purely domestic story.
Yeah.
That it would be weird to write about environmental lawsuits.
Right.
And not write about the foreign, mostly international NGOs who are trying to support environmental lawyers and environmental lawsuits and the development of public interest law in China. And so, you know, I'd say like once every 2 weeks or around that much, I would get an email or something like that announcing some kind of roundtable or training program or workshop on one of those themes, whether it was environmental law or there was a lot on public interest law and public interest litigation. These were ideas that were really very much in the intellectual ether and really being promoted by a range of international NGOs. So I felt like I had to write something about those efforts
and
the kind of effect that I thought they were having.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think, I mean, based upon what you viewed, what do you think the efficacy of these programs are?
Well, I think, I don't, you know, I tried to write the chapter right down the middle. People react to it really differently.
Yeah.
But what I was trying to say was I think that they have some successes in an extremely difficult environment for action. I think what's challenging is that these programs have been caught up in the seduction of quantification.
Yeah.
There's a ton of pressure to count things, to have quantifiable outcomes for these programs. And I think often, in a worst-case scenario, that boils down to counting the number of people trained.
Right.
How many trainings can we run? How many can we run in how many different areas of the country? How many people have been there? And I think this is really the wrong approach, because where I see the successes of these programs are not on the mass level. So if you have 100 people at a training, I think 95 of them are going to go back to their same old existence.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you know, that's as we would expect.
Yeah.
I mean, think about how many training, you know, 3-day workshops you've been to and how
I've been to a lot.
Yeah, I mean,
I go back to my old life a lot.
Yeah, me too. Like, I can't think of any 3-day workshop I've been to that's changed the direction of my life. So I think that the effects are most evident for a very small minority of people.
Right.
Who really use these to as springboards to really change their life and their commitments.
Right.
And I also think they can be really effective in promoting ideas and putting ideas into circulation and discussion that were not there before. So I think those effects are really important, but they're almost impossible to quantify.
Right.
Which is why it's so frustrating for donors.
I know, yeah. And I mean, in the past, like, couple of months, I mean, you have seen some foreign donors, like the Canadian government and the Swedish government, pulling out its aid to China on a lot of these projects. And, I mean, do you think it's a smart move? I mean, what do you think will be the result if more donors followed suit and pulled out aid from China for projects like this?
I think donors have been pulling out because the economic argument of providing aid to China holds absolutely no water anymore. It's clear that China
isn't very wealthy.
I mean, they should be giving us aid if you look at it as a tool for economic development or something like that. I'm waiting for the discourse to shift so that we look at these programs as a tool of diplomacy.
Yeah.
Which is really how I see them.
Yeah, and I think you note that in the book, and I think that's important that I think gets lost in the shuffle about quantifying all of these projects, is that you learn who's on the ground. If you do the projects right, you learn who's on the ground in, like, remote areas that's doing really cool work, and that can help, you know, you can find out who those people are and see what's really happening and stuff.
So. Yeah, I mean, your question was about what we're going to lose.
Yeah.
And when I think about what we're going to lose, one of the big things I think about is we're going to lose a lot of knowledge about China.
No.
Because the people who have been involved in these projects for a really long time, thinking about folks at the Ford Foundation or the American Bar Association.
Right.
These are some of the Americans who are most knowledgeable about what's going on in China, and, you know, some of very few American voices that are on the ground participating in any way in domestic debates over what should happen with rule of law.
Right. So, just in closing, where do you see environmental litigation and or the environmental movement, now that you're comfortable calling it that, where do you see it going in China in the future?
Well, the environmental movement is totally going to take off. Now that it's here and I'm comfortable with it, I'm going to predict.
Now that you've written a book, it's going to take off.
No, I really think so, though, because I just see growing demand for reduction of risk. So not just environment, but also food safety.
Yeah.
There is no question that Chinese citizens are and have a right to expect, and increasingly will expect government regulation to reduce risk in their lives. I'm not exactly sure what form that reduction of risk is going to take.
I'm not sure.
It may take the form of regulation and beefing up regulatory agencies as opposed to courts and judges. That's the part that's not clear. I do think that the Chinese government will be responsive to these demands for risk reduction, but exactly how they're going to be responsive is not yet clear. And this area is changing so fast.
Yeah.
It was so hard to let this book go off to the publishers because the story is changing every year. You know, between when I started this book and when I finished it, laws on standing changed, 95 environmental courts opened around the nation. China, Greenpeace brought their first environmental lawsuit in China.
So I guess you already have the second edition ready.
Any day now. Just talk to my publisher about it.
So, thank you for joining us, Rachel. If people are interested in purchasing your book, it is a great book, Environmental Litigation in China, a Study in Political Ambivalence. Where can they do that?
They can buy it on Amazon, and I would be delighted.
Oh, okay, it's on Amazon. That's great. Okay, well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
All right, bye-bye.
This morning I woke, restless and heady, with blood pulsing fierce in the vein. There's light on a line this morning, and maybe forever, I move with regard for the signs. You know I've searched my heart to prove there's better ways to push and pull. Hey, whatever gets you through these